Welcome to Everyday Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, nurse practitioner, Cynthia Thurlow. This podcast is designed to educate, empower, and inspire you to achieve your health and wellness goals. My goal and intent is to provide you with the best content and conversations from leaders in the health and wellness industry each week and impact over a million lives. Today, I had the honor of connecting with Doug Bopst. He's an award-winning personal trainer, author, and host of the Adversity Advantage podcast, and he's on a crusade to inspire others to overcome adversity and become the best version of themselves. He's also a former convicted felon and drug addict who spent time in jail for possession with intent to sell. Today, we discussed the role of gratitude, connection, how exercise can allow you to face your fears, connect to yourself, the role of healthy versus unhealthy habits, and how external validation can be a cage, the impact of grit and fortitude, faith, and getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. I know you will enjoy this conversation as much as I did recording it. Doug, so good to connect with you. Like I said earlier, I feel like I have known you because we had so many shared coincidences as we started having conversations in our DMs and texting back and forth. There are far too many coincidences. We must have been meant to be friends and be connected.
It's great to be here, Cynthia, and you're right. Like I was telling you, I haven't met anybody that had as many mutual connections as you and I did, like right off the bat. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation and looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, I would love to really start our discussion today talking about gratitude. Obviously, I know this is something that has been important to your journey, something that's really important to my journey. But how has gratitude shaped your life at this stage of your existence?
Listen, I'm grateful to be alive. Like when I was younger, I didn't think I was going to live to see my 25th birthday. And if it wasn't for my cellmate, Eric, really getting me involved in fitness when I was incarcerated on felony drug charges, I mean, I probably would have ended up dead. I mean, to be honest, just because before I went to jail, I had a horrific addiction to OxyContin. I was selling drugs. I was doing other drugs. And I was hopeless. I was in the depths of despair. I had no goals, no aspirations, no self-esteem at all. And there were nights where I would crush up like a line of OxyContin and a line of Coke. And I would be like, I wonder if I snorted this and I didn't wake up, like if anybody would remember me, or if people would come to my funeral, or if people would actually care. And so that just paints an idea of how my life was before I went to jail. And so I didn't think I was going to make it that long. And also because I went to, you know, many funerals when I was a kid of people that I hung out with, not just people that I would, you know, see on Facebook or people that I maybe went to school with, like people that were in my like friend group. I was going to funerals as a kid. So it wasn't that far-fetched that I would end up, you know, on a very similar path. And so I say that because I'm just so thankful to be where I am today and doing what I'm doing. And I try to just kind of encapsulate that in the way that I conduct myself, whether it's through my podcast, whether it's through conversations like I'm having here, whether it's just through my relationships or with my family now. Just because I am so grateful that I was given a chance to turn my life around, and also grateful that I had this guy come into my life when I didn't even believe in myself, that he believed in me enough to give me this chance to find out how much my life was actually worth living.
That's really so profoundly inspiring. And certainly when I was reading your book and doing research for this conversation, this is probably not something we have explored on the podcast before. And so, you know, from my perspective, having trained in Baltimore at that time in the 1990s, it was the height of the heroin crisis, the HIV and AIDS crisis, teen pregnancy, syphilis. I mean, like Baltimore was number one for everything. And yet what's interesting is Baltimore still plays a really significant role in not just drug fatalities, but overdoses, you know, from predominantly fentanyl now. Fentanyl appears to be really on the rise. But I think, you know, there's really no coincidence that, you know, I'm hearing your story and I'm realizing that there must have been something intrinsically unique to you that you took what could have been the start of a long trajectory, either continuing with drug addiction and or being in jail, but meeting this individual, Eric, in jail, was the precipitant and spark for taking your the trajectory of your life in a completely different direction. And so I think we have to acknowledge that there are no coincidences, that I really fervently believe that this is the path you were meant to take to have you catapulted to a whole other level of influence in a really positive way. And so when you talk about, you know, this kind of self-destructiveness of drug use and not dealing with uncomfortable feelings, was that common for your friend circle? Because you do talk quite a bit on social media and in podcasts about how influential your friend circle is, how much impact they can make on the choices that you yourself are embracing. And do you think that that played a role given your upbringing? And, you know, I'm also a child of divorce, so I want to be really clear. I know what that's like. But do you feel like your friend circle at that point in time, given what you're sharing, had a large impact on where you were in time and space and middle, high school and early adulthood?
In different ways, yes. I mean, and I say that just because when you grow up in a broken home and my parents got divorced, there wasn't a lot of communication between the two of them. So, you know, I saw that and I witnessed that as a kid. Again, no shame to either one of my parents. That's just the reality of the situation. And I think just based on what I've learned, just through a lot of wisdom and just through talking to a lot of people, when you have a void like that, you will find that in other places. So I think I clung on to my peers and friend groups and did whatever I could to fit in because I needed connection in whatever way I possibly could, even if those friends were making poor decisions, even if they were making fun of me, even if I was being laughed at all the time by them, whatever the case was. And I think for me, like it started out just trying to fit in with my friends and just doing drugs and getting high because I thought that's what the cool thing was. And then eventually, and I think everybody or a lot of people who experience addiction deal with this. It's like you start out and it's really fun. It's a great fix for your problems. It's a great thing. And then eventually you get to a point where now it's not fun anymore. You're doing the thing to escape the pain and the misery that you've created in your life by, you know, these addictive and destructive behaviors. And as far as my friends, like, I don't know if they were inherently like mad at themselves or felt poorly about themselves. And that's why they were doing drugs. I think they were doing it because, at least from what I understood, because it was like the party thing, it was the cool thing to do. I was battling in many ways very silently. I mean, my friends knew what my family situation was like. They knew that I was upset that I didn't have any luck with girls. They knew that I was upset I wasn't good at sports. Like, I think that was pretty clear. But the self-hatred that existed with inside of me, the feeling that there was something inherently wrong with me, or I thought there was something inherently wrong with me, the feeling that I was a complete failure, it was a very silent battle. And I think that the more I did the drugs, the more I realized that I needed to just numb out and I needed not to think about anything because life was just too hard if I didn't have those drugs. And I think also on top of that is that I think our environment creates a false sense of normalcy. And I talk about this a lot in that, like, one of the things that is probably drawn you and I to each other is that we have a lot of the same common interests. We're both podcasters. We're both in the health and wellness space. We have a lot of mutual friends. We're both like on this mission to help people. That's common ground, right? And so it's normal for us to spend time like this together and to communicate. And that feels like we want to be around other people that are doing this. Well, when you're in the thick of addiction, you create this whole new sense of normalcy. In the example that I use, let's just say that, like, I'm married to somebody. I'm not married, but let's just say I'm going to the bar every single day and I'm drinking day in and day out. I come home. My wife is like, you have a problem. Like, you're drinking every single day and you're not going to work. You're not doing this. Like, you have a problem. And then I'm like, well, everybody else is doing it. Like, what do you mean? And so I say that because you create this false sense of normalcy and that all of my friends around me were doing the exact same thing. And you end up like graduating friend groups too, because it's very similar in like our space, how like people aren't growing around you. You slowly evolve and trying to find new people that are growing. In that the people that I was just smoking weed with, once I started to sell drugs or once I started to do coke or other hard drugs, I didn't have anything in common with them anymore. So I had to make new friends and I had to like keep graduating friend groups because I needed to feel like the situation around me was normal, because what that would do was that would normalize my behavior. There was no self-accountability. I could sit there and I can blame people for my problems. I could feel like it was a normal situation. And so I guess to bring this full circle, yes, my friend group did have this tremendous impact on my behavior, but I think I got a rude awakening when I was in jail when Eric, my cellmate, pointed out the fact that I was blaming everybody else for my problems but myself. I wasn't taking any accountability. I wasn't taking any responsibility. I wasn't looking at myself in the mirror and realizing that regardless of my situation, regardless of how people were treating me, regardless of what my friends were doing, I still had autonomy in the way I behaved. And it wasn't until I realized that, not only realized that, but actually started to swing the pendulum in the other way to start taking ownership for my choices that my life started to get better.
Well, and I think for 80%, 90% of the population, I sometimes will say that there's this degree of self-evolution, self-reflection, self-evolution. And the majority of people, it's very hard to look at yourself introspectively and say, I'm doing this really well, and this requires some work. And I have to really applaud you to have gone from all that degree of adversity and then doing the internal work, because really it sounds like when you met this individual in jail, it spurned you to challenge your limiting beliefs, irrespective of what they were, and to have you realize that you deserved to be happy, healthy, be in a healthy mindset. And I feel like in many ways, when we're ready for the message, oftentimes the teacher appears.
And I think that is true. I think for me, what I will say is initially I wasn't ready. I mean, when I first got to jail, Eric approached me about exercising and I told him, like, good luck, man. Like, I could have been a model for Pillsbury at the time. I had no interest in exercising with him. It wasn't until having this conversation and him, you know, pointing out the fact that I was being a victim, that I was blaming everybody else for my problems, and that I did have power. I had control, because for a while I thought that I had no control and that I was powerless and that no matter what I did, I was going to be a complete failure. I didn't realize that, you know, I still had some power and life wasn't over and I still had an opportunity to turn things around. And then I also, at that point, when him and I were having this conversation, you know, the drugs had started to get out of my system, or they might have been even completely almost out of my system at that point. And I realized, like, well, clearly I didn't have everything figured out at that point my life. Like, I had 21 jobs by the time I was 21 before I went to jail. I was a drug addict, was selling drugs, damaged relationships with my family, like, you know, no career, like nothing. And I was like, well, maybe there's an opportunity for me to actually make a different choice in my life. And I also, like, wanted more for myself. I think a lot of people, when they're struggling and they're in the thick of it, like I was, they want more for themselves. But the reality is they just don't know how to change, or they think that it's so far away that there's even no point in trying, or they assume that something's going to happen along the way that's going to get them to sidetrack and fail or whatever, and they don't even try. And I think that's why it was very useful for me when I was in jail that Eric and I just started with the basics when it came to exercise. Like, I couldn't do a push-up from my knees when I first got to jail at all. And so when I finally, you know, got convinced to give this exercise thing a shot, I remember getting down to do the push-up from my knees, couldn't. And I felt so mad at myself and I felt like a failure. But when I was able to do that push-up from my knees, the amount of self-confidence that I got, like, it was life-changing. Like, I always tell people, and it's like, I've done some amazing stuff in my fitness career. And I don't say this to brag. I'm just saying, this is just the reality of the situation. And that, you know, I've done like 30 pull-ups without stopping. I've done over 100 push-ups without stopping. I've held a plank for nearly 10 minutes. I've had, you know, 5% body. I've had all this stuff, but nothing compares to how good I felt after being able to do a single push-up. Nothing will ever touch that. Because the level of self-confidence that it gave me, because I was like at negative 10, you know, or whatever, going from that to one, wherever that brought me, it was the catalyst for everything that I do now and for my entire transformation, because it felt like that I had just climbed Mount Everest. I mean, then I was able to do, you know, 2 push-ups from my knees, 3. And now I'm like doing a set of 10 for my knees, which was seemed like I would have had a better chance of winning the lottery and the Mega Millions, you know, versus me being able to do a set of 10 push-ups, either for my feet or for my knees by the time my jail sentence was over. But that, it just completely shaped who I am as a person, completely transformed the way that I view habits, fitness, self-discipline. And I have no one to thank. I have, you know, my cellmate to thank for all of that. And yeah, I played a role in it for sure. But if it wasn't for him pushing me, holding me accountable, believing in me when I couldn't, I wouldn't be, you know, talking to you right now.
I've been using MitoPure for the last 2 years, and I've added this to my routine for multiple reasons. Number one, it's a foundational supplement for me and my family. It keeps things simple, and I know that I cannot get enough of urolithin A in my food to derive the same benefits. And if you're not familiarized with urolithin A, it's a signaling molecule, but it's also actively involved in anti-aging, energy production. And I take Timeline because of its remarkable healthy aging solution that activates key critical cellular pathways in my body, It's a total game changer for healthy aging. I alternate between using the soft gels and powder, depending on whether or not I'm traveling. And we know that restoring cellular energy is a key to enduring health. And this is concluded in a recent publication in Nature Metabolism, which is a top scientific journal, identifying that newly energized cells may provide many more years of healthy life to people. Yet as we age, we know that cellular energy production naturally declines and reduces our prospects of optimal health and longevity. That's the great thing about Timeline, is you can restore cellular energy and support healthy aging. I've noticed the biggest improvements in my energy and sleep levels. We know that Timeline is clinically shown to give our cellular energy generators, the mitochondria, new power. And when taken daily, it replaces aging mitochondria, so it upregulates mitophagy and rebuilds new ones, or mitogenesis. Timeline is the only nutrient that can do what it does. So Timeline renews your cells to a more powerful state. My listeners can get 10% off your first order at timeline.com/Cynthia. That's 10% off at timeline.com/Cynthia. I know you're going to love this product. Just as you carefully choose the cut of meat or freshness of produce that you cook at home, you should carefully choose chemical-free cookware that provides a healthy and safe cooking experience. The materials in 360 cookware are safe, sustainable, and of the highest quality. Their cookware is 100% free from any toxic chemicals, as the company produces quality stainless steel cookware and bakeware without added chemicals, and all are manufactured in the United States. It's also the leading manufacturer that equips kitchens with cookware and bakeware that are free of all of the toxic chemicals and coatings, including PFAS, Teflon, and ceramic. And the best thing is that when used properly, the product's construction provides nonstick properties in a product that can be passed down through generations. Go to www.360cookware.com and use code Cynthia20 for 20% off your first order. Again, that's 360cookware.com and use code Cynthia20 for 20% off your first order. We've been using their products over the last several months and have really been pleased with not only the durability, but ease of cleanliness. I think it's really so inspiring to hear about this catalyst from exercise. What is it about exercise beyond the sense of accomplishment and the physicality of it? What do you think it is about exercise that for you was this powerful motivator for you to see clarity about what was possible in your life?
I mean, I think there's not many other things that get you comfortable being uncomfortable or being able to face your fears or get developing self-discipline or belief in yourself, like exercise, commitment to yourself. Because like, and I mean, I know you're obviously, you're very big into manifestation and spirituality and stuff. And I think that there's a lot of space for that. But I do think that true confidence doesn't come from like just shouting affirmations out into the sky. I think it comes from like validating your beliefs in yourself with the actions that you take. And so I think exercise is one of the easiest wins to do that. Like if you tell yourself you care about yourself and that you love yourself and that you want to be healthier, well, then you should one of the things you should do on a regular basis is exercise, whatever that looks like for you. It could be walking for 5 minutes. It could be lifting weights for an hour, depending on where you're at. And I just think it gives you this unmatchable level of confidence, because you're proving to yourself that you can change and that you can evolve and you can grow. And I think for somebody like myself that was so focused on the past and was convinced that I was going to die by 25, was convinced that I was going to remain a drug addict for the rest of my life, was so mad at everybody else in my life, it became this vehicle to propel me towards something in the future. Because now I was like, all right, like here's some goals that I want. I want to be able to do the set of 10 pushups before I leave jail. I want to be able to run a mile. Then after that, I want to do these things. And it also allowed me to channel a lot of this negative pain that I had in my life. And I've heard other people in the personal development space talk about this. And I learned it firsthand, where when I got to jail, there were people in jail telling me when I couldn't do a pushup, they were like, think about what makes you angry. And I was so disconnected from my body that I couldn't even think about what would make me angry. And that's another thing that exercise does, is it gets you connected to yourself again. I mean, think about all that has to happen for you to be able to do a push-up or to squat. Like there's so many things that have to actually happen. And so once I learned how to tap into that, and I could think about the things that did upset me, whether it was being bullied in school or when kids would tell me that I looked like I had Down syndrome or girls rejecting me or something with my parents, I learned that I could somehow process a lot of that sadness into something meaningful. And it also became this incredible tool for me to reattach behavior to emotion. And I mean, a lot of it, it's funny, like now you hear a lot about it now. All of this was all just like trial and error with me. Like I had no idea any of this was going to work in the way that it did. But what I realized is that my go-to coping mechanism for stress, anxiety, depression, you name it, was drugs. It was drama. It was anger. It was sadness. It was create, you know, it was manipulation, all these things that was my normal. Well, in jail, I couldn't do that because if I acted out in anger, I would have gotten the crap beaten out of me by somebody, or I would have gotten into solitary confinement, or I would have fill in the blank. Something could have happened to me that would have made my life worse. So there was no choice. So I was forced to sit in that discomfort and choose something differently. And thankfully, I had this thing called exercise to where when I got stressed or anxious, that became a great tool for me to channel all that. And that carried with me, you know, not only throughout the course of, you know, not only throughout like my early days out of jail, but throughout the course of my life.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for each one of us, I've started speaking more openly about this on the podcast. I grew up with an alcoholic parent and I never fully appreciated and or realized how much that impacted behaviors that I had. You know, I was very achievement oriented. If I achieved, my parents left me alone. If they left me alone, I could do my own thing. And it's taken many years of therapy. And I know we both have connected with Gabor Mate, and Gabor and I had a whole conversation about, he said, you realize that someone that's an alcoholic, the degree of pain that they're trying to numb themselves from. And I think in a lot of different levels, you know, I view my parents very compassionately. And I acknowledge that maybe it's our generation, your generation, where we're talking more openly about feelings, we're sharing more about our experiences. And I think in so many ways, hearing your story inspires me to be even more conscientious about sharing my experiences and, you know, being more transparent with my children. I have two teenagers who are not perfect, just like I'm perfectly imperfect. But I think through that journey, our own experiences growing up, it allows us to have the opportunity to inspire others. And I think that, you know, certainly hearing your story, reading your story, listening to your story, both when you were a guest on other podcasts and on your own podcast, really left me with this indelible impression. So yes, I believe that exercise was something that allowed you to be more connected to yourself and your feelings. But intrinsically, I fervently believe that whether you were aware of it or not, that you chose while you were in jail to change the trajectory of where things were going. Because like I mentioned earlier, I think it could have been easy to kind of fall back into pre-existing patterns. And you mentioned, you know, you were disconnected from family members and from peers and feeling like in many ways you weren't seen. And now in many, completely the opposite is now the case, that you are on a very visible platform. You're inspiring so many other with your words and also sharing your own experiences very transparently.
I appreciate that. And, you know, I think exercise definitely was something that was the catalyst for all of this. And I mean, I still had problems when I got out of jail, like you alluded to, like I was disconnected from family members. I was still angry at myself and at my past. And I think like the goal, it's funny, like when the trajectory of my fitness goals has evolved over the years, where initially it was about survival. I was like, all right, I need to find something that's not a drug that can keep me sane, right? And then once I saw some progress, it was like, huh, I've seen these guys who are ripped get, you know, have pretty girlfriends. I've seen these guys who are ripped. I think they're happy and they have all the things. I'm going to go after that. Like, that's going to be my goal. I'm going to get an 8-pack or whatever. And then I did that. Like, I pursued it hard and quick and fast. You know, I got Arnold Schwarzenegger's Encyclopedia of Bodybuilding. You know, I started to read more. You know, I started reading Muscle and Fitness, which was huge back in the day, and Men's Health and Men's Fitness. And I started to learn more about nutrition and exercise programming and stuff like that. And then what I realized is that my life really didn't get any better. I mean, sure, I felt great physically and I wasn't, you know, using drugs or anything, but I still had that same sadness. I still had this, what's wrong with me? Why am I not happy? I still had this level of cognitive dissonance when I looked in the mirror because, you know, I was bullied a lot when I was a kid and I was called names and I was, you know, told things that you would never want your kids to even hear, right? And so in my 20s, once I started to lose weight and look a certain way, people were like, you look like Mark Wahlberg. And I thought that initially was an insult because I was so used to people talking to me in a certain way that I like didn't even know if that was, I couldn't figure out if it was a compliment or an insult. And then I realized it was a compliment. But I say that because I would look in the mirror and I still would see the old version of me because I hadn't processed a lot of the old version of me. I mean, I wasn't using drugs. I had found this new passion in fitness. My life was significantly better, no doubt. But I still had a lot of resentment towards my mom, my dad, and my childhood, all these things. And so it forced me to go to therapy and really dig into a lot of that and figure out how to rewire some of those neural pathways, how to change the way I talk to myself. I mean, Cynthia, I would literally, because I was like so worried that I still was like the past version of me in some ways, I would have to write down on a piece of paper, like, who was I in the past? What was I doing? What kind of people was I spending time with? And then like, what was I doing now? Just so I could like see as some sort of validation that I had significantly changed. And then I learned about this concept called homeostasis, which as I understand it, it's like this level of normal, like physiological normalcy. And my therapist at the time was like, how did you grow up? And I was telling her, you know, my parents got divorced. I was bully, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, no, like, what was life? Was life stressful? Was it, were you anxious? And I was like, oh, I was anxious and stressed all the time. And she's like, yeah, that's your normal. Your body has adapted to surviving in stress. Because what would happen is not only was I upset with myself about still about the past and the resentments, but I was getting anxious and stressed over nothing, where I was like a single guy making great money as a trainer, like no real problems, but I was still stressed all the time. And so I had to understand like how to deal with that. And that was also normal given my circumstances. And then the biggest thing was just having also hard conversations with specifically my mom, who I felt like I really did the most damage to. I mean, I was a jerk to her when I was a teenager, and she ended up kicking me out on my 16th birthday, which, I mean, changed the trajectory of my childhood permanently. Like, I moved, kicked out of her house. I was no longer living with her half the time. Went to a brand new school, went to live with my dad full time, who I didn't have the greatest relationship with. And then we didn't communicate barely. I mean, there was times where I wasn't even allowed in her house. And it really took a toll on me mentally, because I felt abandoned. I felt angry. I felt all the things. And now that I've, you know, matured and I've gotten past that, I realized it wasn't intentional. She was just trying to do the best that she could with which the tools she had in front of her. And it wasn't, you know, addiction wasn't talked about, or mental health like it is today. This is back in 2003, right? When I got kicked out. So it's totally different today. And so it was having hard conversations with her and apologizing and, you know, being vulnerable and admitting that I was wrong, and her admitting that she wishes she would have done stuff differently, that kind of opened the gates to building not just a surface level connection where we were saying, I'm sorry, but where we actually understood each other and had compassion and started to build like a meaningful relationship together. And so doing that, forgiving my dad, looking at my past and coming to terms with it, becoming a Christian, like these things were very pivotal for me in redefining my relationship with external validation. Because now I wasn't seeking attention from fitness or vanity, because I would walk around my shirt off around the gym, and I would like, or, you know, walking outside with my shirt off and people would see me. And it was just a very weird time for me, because I look back now and I'm like, I can't believe I did some of the stuff that I did. Or I would just date girls because they were pretty, just to make myself feel good, only to for things not to work out, or me to realize that I got myself into something that I shouldn't have only because I wanted attention. And so once I started to do all that work, all that stuff subsided, where it wasn't about how the way I looked necessarily anymore. It wasn't about just going after somebody because of just purely their looks. It wasn't about like any of that. It was more about, because I had healed my intimate, a lot of my intimate, you know, relationships with my family and healed the relationship with myself. I wasn't looking for as much external validation anymore to fill that massive void. Hopefully that all made sense.
No, it did. And I want to acknowledge that you talked about the trauma and stress that you grew up in. We know that individuals that are exposed to a lot of trauma as children, I'm one of them myself, these call them adverse childhood events. There's these ACE scores and how that can influence our autonomic nervous system. So you mentioned, you know, you were like hyper responsive to everything because that's how your nervous system had been conditioned. So that requires quite a bit of effort to convince your body that you're safe, you're in a safe space, you can relax, you don't have to be hyper vigilant, hyper reactive. And, you know, that in and of itself requires a lot of work and a lot of self-reflection. And so I want to acknowledge that. And then you mentioned the external validation piece, which was one of my next questions I was going to talk about. You mentioned that external validation is a cage. When we're looking for validation of ourselves, if we're a woman, we're a man, whether it's through attention from the opposite sex or the same sex, or buying expensive clothes or cars or taking expensive vacations, how does someone, if they're listening to this, how do we do the internal work so that we stop putting so much emphasis on things that are less important? Does that make sense?
Yeah, listen, it's it's
easier
tough.
Said than done.
Well, I think it's easier said than done. And one of the main reasons is because a lot of this is like valid and healthy. Like, you know, health is still important. Like the way, I think there is something to be said for the way that you look and having a low and healthy level of body fat percentage. I mean, I think that's a healthy thing. I think having great relationships, being attracted to your partner, I think that's all normal. And I think, you know, wanting more for yourself and chasing after money. I mean, I think that's normal. Like, I think it is. Success is a normal part of life. Where I think it gets slippery is where it's the end all be all, where if you notice yourself, like for me, I'll just speak in my own experience. Like I was traveling on airplanes with chicken and broccoli because I was afraid. Like I would go to, you know, I talked about, you know, that, you know, Todd Durkin, who went to middle school with, I think for a few years, was a longtime mentor of mine and somebody who's also been very instrumental in my life. I would go out to see him like on the West Coast and I would like bring, you know, frozen chicken and broccoli with me on the plane because I was afraid that if I ate anything else that I would gain weight you wouldn't be able to see like one of my abs or whatever. And it wasn't because I was competing in some competition. It was because in my mind, I was like, I'm not lovable if I don't look this way, or I'm going to be miserable with myself if I don't look this way. And so if you're having thoughts like that, where the reason you're eating so healthy or you're so attached to exercise is because you think that you're unlovable otherwise, like I think that's time to like reevaluate, you know, go to therapy or hire some sort of coach that's skilled in that kind of thing, and or meet, go to community support groups or whatever you think is doable with where you're at. You know, if your level of happiness is dependent upon how other people view you, I think that's a problem. But again, that's also a slippery slope because you need feedback in your life. Like if I were to sit here and I were to call you a name, like, you know, I should look at myself in the mirror after you saying something to me and be like, you know, I shouldn't have said that. Like there's a difference and there's a fine line. But I think people listening to this, hopefully you understand what I mean, in that if you're so dependent on how people view you and validation, and that you are posting stuff on social media because you're lonely and you want to get a bunch of likes, like that's a problem. If you're posting something on social media though, because you genuinely want to post something that's inspiring to you and to help others, that's a different story, right? Or if you truly feel that you're ready to date and looking for a partner because you feel secure with yourself and you feel like that's going to add something to your life, then that's one thing. The external validation that you'll get is probably healthy and it's going to elevate who you are as a person if it's with the right person. But if you're feeling down on yourself and you're like, yo, you know what? I'm going to get on a dating app and just see how much attention I can get from, in my case, from women. Like that's a problem, right? Because now I'm using that one thing that was once good for something that's super negative. So I just think it all comes back to self-awareness and understanding yourself and finding a way to help you get self-aware so that you can understand how these behaviors are impacting you, because it is a journey. And for me, the hardest part of it all was the health part, because you got to remember, like health saved my life. Like the way that my habits around health and fitness saved my life, like not eat, like I was on a diet when I was in jail because my cellmate knew, and you know this, you're a coach and you practitioner, you get this, that in order for people to stay motivated, they got to see results. And honestly, it's like one of the most under-talked about things is you have to see results. Like you have to see, so he knew that if I cut out certain foods and I cut my calories, I would see results, and I did. So what did that do? I mean, it kept me motivated because I was also feeling better about myself. I was also accomplishing the physical stuff as well. But then when I got out of jail, I was like, all right, if I don't eat a certain way, does this mean that I'm going to get fat again? Does this mean I'm going to go back to doing drugs? Does this mean that I'm going to gain weight? And so it was that battle inside my mind that I had to figure out how to harness it. And again, it came back to, I looked at the context of the rest of my life and that I was sacrificing certain relationships because I didn't want to go out to eat. And I was at home like eating like tilapia and, you know, asparagus at night, you know, watching, you know, TV or something. When I should have been, when I was like 23 or 24, I should have been like out with my friends. Like that's what you're supposed to do. And so I took a lot of therapy. It took a lot of just reevaluating my relationship with health and figuring out what was important to me. But again, if you're listening to this and you're in that spot, just realize it's okay. It's an easy trap to fall into, especially in the year that we're in now. And just figure out like what's the next good, easy next step for you to do to be able to combat this and try to turn things around.
I think that, you know, you bring up some really good points, you know, talking about if your desire to be healthy is to be exactly that healthy, that's very different than orthorexia. You know, people that go to extremes that they're concerned about their food being contaminated if they go to a restaurant or if their food touches another ingredient. I mean, I've heard so many different variations of this. I'm known for intermittent fasting. I have some people, I have to tell them to stop fasting because they have such an unhealthy relationship with eating or not eating that it's no longer serving them. And I think that's really what you're speaking to, is if you feel like you have an unhealthy habit, get some help, get some support, get some coaching that will help you kind of get into a different mindset or perhaps even consider, you know, formal therapy, which I'm a huge proponent of. I tell everyone, I think I will be intermittently in therapy for the rest of my life. And sometimes things will trigger me and I realize that's something I need to work on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, speaking of the fasting thing, and I know that's your jam and I'm sure we'll talk about it when you come on my show. I have this rule with my clients where it's like, for a lot of my clients, I should say that like, they're not allowed to bring up any fat, kind of not fad, but anything outside of like the norm until they've mastered drinking enough water, their sleep's on point, they're getting enough protein, they're getting enough fiber, and they're strength training like regularly. Like when they do that, I'll talk about anything. I'll give my perspective because I think it's important for people just to master the fundamentals. Because I think for me, like I was always looking for the quick fixes to fix my mental health, right? Like I wasn't, you know, at first I wasn't willing to do the deep work to go into therapy and working on my relationships and all that. I was looking for exercise to fill that void. Because as a kid, you know, I thought that if I looked a certain way and if I got attention from certain people, that I would be happy, because the inverse was true. Like I didn't look a certain way and I wasn't getting attention from certain people and I was miserable. So I thought if I did the opposite, my life would change. And it was just a very sad story, obviously, that it didn't. But I just think that, you know, in this world where everything is so confusing with, you know, you got so many diet tribes out there and so much information and confusion, I do think it's important to master the fundamentals first and focusing on that. Because listen, if you're getting enough protein, fiber, you're strength training, you're sleeping well, and you're drinking enough water, you're probably doing better than 95% of the people out there. And I think that's an important point. Now, fasting obviously can be a great tool for people if it works. Like fasting worked great for my schedule as a trainer because I had clients from like 6 a.m. to noon. So I couldn't eat. You know, I could, but people would get a little mad at me for bringing out like eggs and oatmeal at, you know, 8 a.m. But I think, you know, when people are listening to this and trying to figure out a place to start to like improve their life, I think it's like, well, what's the lowest hanging fruit that gives the biggest pop for you? And I think in the exercise space I just mentioned, I think in the mental health space, at least from my personal experience, it's looking at the people you spend time with. It's getting outside in nature. It's finding a spirituality practice that works for you. It's finding some form of therapy, whether that's one-on-one or some sort of online support group. And it's developing some sort of self-awareness practice where you're able to understand like what you're doing and thinking on a daily basis and how that's all intertwined with where you want to go in your life.
Now, you may be surprised to hear me say this, but I 100% agree with you. I think that whether it is keto, carnivore, intermittent fasting, veganism, whatever it is that people are trending on or they're interested in, if you're not doing the bare bone basics, moving your body, hydrating your body, sleeping, women in particular, if I can't get a woman to sleep through the night, I tell them, do not start fasting. Do not add another stressor to your existence. And to your point about strength training, gosh, a la Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, who's had an enormous impact on the trajectory of my knowledge and my own career. I always give her credit. And I tell people all the time, if you're not getting enough protein, especially as a middle-aged person, that loss of muscle mass is going to have catastrophic impact on your metabolic health. And so stop doing all the chronic cardio and start doing more strength training, and you will see substantial impact on your health, not just your metabolic health, your mental health. I was in the gym this morning. I was thinking about our discussion today, you know, what direction I want to take things in. And I really think in many ways, physical activity, going to the gym, whether you work out at home or you work out in a gym, whatever works for your personal schedule, but that consistent investment in yourself is something that no one can ever take away from you. And the confidence that being healthy brings to you, I'm at a stage in my life where I'm now becoming an outlier, and I don't want that to be the case. I want everyone to be as healthy as my husband and I are. But the unfortunate thing, if you look at the statistics, that's not the direction things are heading in. And it's always a concern of mine, but I 100% fervently agree with you that you've got to get the basics down first before you start adding in more advanced strategies, strategies that could work really well. But don't focus on just being carnivore when you don't move your body and you're chronically dehydrated and your sleep is in the toilet.
Right. I mean, I posted on Twitter or X or whatever you call it. And I think I said something like,
it'll always be Twitter.
If you're focusing on removing seed oils, but you're not strength training, like it's time to reevaluate your priorities. And I think I said that just because like, I'm honestly not the smartest person when it comes to like the research behind like seed oils and stuff, but I do see it gets a lot of attention. But I see people and I'm like, well, I mean, I hope that you're strength training and that you're doing all the basics first, because that's going to give you way more than removing seed oils, where if you're not exercising, you're not strength training, like, I mean, you're missing the boat. Like, I think there's like pain's this ultimate lever in life, right? Where you can use it to your advantage. Like, I'm sure like a lot of the choices that have changed your life or choices that I've made that have changed my life came from, in many ways, moments of pain where you got angry or you got sad or you got upset and you figured out like, all right, no more of this. I'm going to do something about this, whether it was a big or small change. Also, with that said, I think people make poor decisions when they're in pain. Where they go through a breakup, they lose their job. It gives them this, I don't want to say excuse, but it gives them almost this right to say, okay, I'm going to just solve all my problems with something that's unhealthy. I think when you're in the gym, it's the ultimate way to have a good relationship with pain. Because whether you're trying to, for me, if I'm trying to build a bigger bicep, I have to train that muscle till near failure. I have to keep, you know, lifting heavier, doing more reps until I almost fail for it to grow. If you're trying to run a faster mile, you literally have to, in some way, fatigue your lungs, fatigue your respiratory system, your cardiovascular system, for you to develop enough endurance and enough capacity to be able to run further or faster. If you're trying to hold a pose in yoga longer, there's going to be a little bit of discomfort and pain. So you see where I'm going with this, and that I think that carries over to life, because you're just slowly convincing yourself that you can persevere and push through discomfort and hard times. And when things get challenging, you don't give up on yourself. Like, I think the main reason that people go to the gym when they've exercised for so long isn't necessarily for the gains in the gym. I'm trying to obviously grow my biceps because I'm a guy and I just think that's what guys typically like to do. I'm half kidding, but I think, you know, obviously that's a goal for most guys. But in the reality, it's like, I go for my mental health. I go because I take care of myself. I go because I develop discipline. And I know that even though I don't feel like doing it, I still do it, because I know that if I don't feel like going to the gym and I don't go to the gym, I know there's going to be other things where if I don't feel like going on a podcast, I'm not going to go on the podcast. And I think you have to develop that muscle of grit and fortitude and just showing up even when you're feeling a little hurt, even when you're tired, even when you're stressed, because that's going to teach you that when life gets hard, when things get hard, you don't curl up in a ball. You've taught yourself that you can fight back and you can keep pushing through. And I think that is the ultimate game changer, because people will look at me now and I'm sure they look at you and they're like, oh, I'm sure your life's easy. Like, you have this podcast, and you have this platform, and you're not using drugs. Like, and I'm like, no, like, I still have problems. Like, I'm still like, I mean, I think last night I got like 4 hours of sleep and I, you know, I'm stressed. I mean, I saw that there was like some crime, like, you know, right by where I live. And I'm like, you know, so life happens. And I say that because the way I deal with it now is much different. It's like, all right, like, I'm not going to beat myself up because I got 4 hours of sleep. I'm going to figure out how I'm going to do better tonight. I'm not going to go and numb myself because I was a little stressed about some crime that happened. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to whatever, fill in the blank. And that just, that carries over. I mean, I think that that is just something that, you know, I think people must develop.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would add that for me, I feel like when I'm in the gym, it's the time I'm not on my phone. Yeah. I mean, I may be listening to a book, I may be listening to a podcast, but I am absolutely present with what I'm doing. And for me, the endorphins that I get from working out, it just kind of allows me to decompress and get out of my head. You know, when I'm in the gym, I'm in the gym. I don't socialize. I'm not an unfriendly person, but like when I'm in the gym, I'm serious about what I'm doing. And so I like to get in, get my workout done and get out so I can get my day started. Now, you touched on a topic that I think a lot of, I'm going to pick on women and just say, I think a lot of women don't work to failure. What does that mean to you as a trainer? Because I 100% agree that when I work out harder to failure, I see more results than when I don't. But it's human nature to avoid pushing your body. It's like, oh, that's a little painful. I don't want to do that. Let me just be very clear. I'm not referring to pain as in you're hurting yourself. It's whether it's lactic acid buildup, whether you've just fatigued that muscle, that it's just, it's no longer wanting to do what you're trying to make it do. But why do you think a lot of people avoid pushing their bodies a little harder than what they want? Is it a mindset piece? Is it a physicality piece? What do you think?
I mean, I think it's a blend of a lot of things. I mean, I think for talking women specifically, and I've trained a lot of women through the years, and it's like, you know, the first thing that they say when I bring up strength training is the first thing they say is, well, I don't want to get bulky, right?
You can't physiologically.
Right. And so that said, I think they, if they're just working out on their own, I think they have this mindset thing like, oh, if I lift heavier or if I really push it, I'm going to get bulky and I'm not going to look the way that I want. Right. So I think there's that. I think there's also the mindset piece where, you know, being comfortable feels really good and not wanting to get hurt and being like, you know what, like, this is what I've done. I'm just going to stick to my routine. I'm not really trying to push it. I'm just here to do my thing. I think that plays a role. And I think also people just maybe just don't really know. You know, they don't really know. I mean, because, you know, if you go and you take a set of dumbbells and you just do like some like half rep fast curls, I mean, that might feel kind of easy to somebody. But when you show them that like you got to really like focus on coming down like slow and then, you know, full range of motion, then come up, squeeze a little bit, come down slow. Now, you know, that 8 to 10 reps feels a lot more challenging because you're going through a full range of motion. You're really activating the muscle in the full capacity. When I say train to failure, it's not like I'm on the bench and I'm having somebody lift the bench off or the bar off of me when it's like, you know, sitting there on my chest after a set. It's more like if my goal is 10 reps, it's trying to get 7 to 8 solid reps where I'm really pushing it. And I have a couple reps left if I needed to, but I'm like kind of saving it. That's like kind of what I mean when it goes to near failure. And so I think it's just, and it's hard, I think, because people also equate failure to just being out of breath. Where, okay, if I'm going to train to failure, that means I'm going to put a circuit of like 9 to 10 different exercises. I'm just going to go all out. I'm going to hit the sled, push-ups, burpees, mountain climbers, box jumps, and I'm training till failure. Well, I mean, you're working your cardiovascular system pretty good. I mean, depending on your heart rate, you're probably working your zone 3 cardio really good or whatever you're at, right? But as far as failure, when it comes to strength training, it's a totally different ballgame. Because remember, like the rest periods in between sets, I mean, depending on what your program looks like, I mean, a program could easily be, I'm going to do a set of squats. I'm going to take a 2 to 3 minute rest. I'm going to go back to it. Or if you're crunched for time, you could do like an upper body and a lower body. You could do a set of squats and then do like a dumbbell row or a bench press and then rest for a few minutes and come back. And by that time, you're, you know, have gotten an adequate rest. So I say that because I think a lot of it, I think, just comes back to understanding. And I think that's why having conversations like this, you know, like Gabrielle Lyon, I know, talks a lot about like, you know, strength training and protein. I think once people have an understanding of what it actually means and that they don't have to just rush through a workout, I think it really allows them to get more comfortable with going to failure. Because I think when people hear failure and they're like, well, I got all this stuff to do, how could I possibly have the energy to go to failure with, you know, a million different exercises if that's how they're. Is that making sense?
No, it totally does. And I think, you know, the other piece that what I'm hearing you talking about is that connection with our bodies, that I know when I'm lifting more slowly, I'm not using momentum. I'm thinking about the muscle that I'm working. And there's actually research to suggest that that connection between your mind or your brain and the muscle that you're working, you will have greater results if you're making that connection of, okay, I'm lifting for my biceps and thinking about your biceps as you're actually lifting, or whether it's your quadriceps, your hamstrings, or some other exercise that you're doing, you know, making that muscle connection with the brain will actually yield more benefits than just kind of going through it mindlessly. And I think a lot of people go to the gym and it's a mindless exercise. They're comfortable, which in and of itself, it has a place. But in the gym, when you're doing the work, like do the work, finish your workout and go on and do the other things you need to do in your life. I think I would rather work really hard for 35 minutes than be in the gym for 2 hours. That's my feeling. I'm all about efficiency.
I mean, because the reality is with a lot of my training clients, we do max 9 different exercises in a session. And, you know, depending on how many days a week they come in or depending on what their goals are, I mean, it's programmed, might have some variations to it, but it's not a lot. I mean, it's like good, solid strength training, adequate rest, good core work, maybe some conditioning at the end if, you know, if that's their goal or they're looking to improve that. Because I think conditioning, I think cardio can be good for sure. But I think the problem becomes when people think of exercise just being cardio, and then that counts in lieu of strength training. Like, I think cardio can be important if it's part of a program, but not when it's like you go into the gym and you're riding the elliptical. Now, I do want to say, like, to the person who's doing that, who hasn't exercised in 20 years, I think that's great. But to the person who's really trying to optimize their program, they've been doing it for a long time, and they've been going to the gym for years, doing the elliptical, doing like a set on the leg press, you know, doing like the seated row machine, you know, casually, and then going home and just saying, oh, I did a couple sets and got my 40 minutes on the elliptical. You know, I would be a terrible coach if I didn't say we should reevaluate and see how we can flip that and get some effective programming in with strength training and then throw a little bit of cardio in at the end to kind of, you know, burn it out or what have you.
Do you find yourself struggling to get a good night's sleep? If so, you may be dealing with a hidden mineral deficiency. It is not at all uncommon in perimenopause and menopause to deal with sleep challenges. And we know that one of many contributory reasons for poor sleep can be a reduction in specific minerals that help regulate sleep quality, including magnesium, which is involved in GABA, which is our body's main calming neurotransmitter. We also know that we need potassium to create melatonin. And this is a hormone that is a master antioxidant, but is also utilized to help induce sleep. We also think about things like zinc, which can balance excitatory neurotransmitters like glutamate. And if it's overactive, meaning if your glutamate levels are too high, it can prevent your brain from becoming more relaxed and inducing sleep. And lastly, selenium increases both our deep sleep and sleep duration. All these minerals matter a lot for sleep, and any imbalances or deficits can have a major impact on the quality of sleep you get each night. And that's why I love Beam Minerals. They offer a full spectrum mineral supplement that gives you every essential mineral your body needs in the right doses, all in a highly absorbable liquid form. All you do is take a shot of Beam Minerals about an hour before bed. Don't worry, it tastes like water, and you'll replenish all of your body's minerals in about 30 seconds and give your brain what it needs for deep restorative sleep. I've been using this product over the last several months. I've really been impressed with the improvement in my sleep metrics, which I like to share on social media with my followers. And if you want a simple way to improve your sleep, head over to www.beamminerals.com and use code Cynthia for 20% off your first order. That's www.beamminerals.com and use code Cynthia for 20% off your first order.
A great deal about our focus on everyday wellness is on supporting gut health. And one of my new favorite ways to recommend to family and friends and even clients is to consider colostrum. And so Equip Foods has an amazing product that helps to improve immunity and gut health and recovery. And each scoop contains grass-fed, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free colostrum. And if you're wondering what colostrum is, it's a nutritional powerhouse that serves as the first source of nutrition for mammals in nature. It's been shown to enhance immune function, gut health, and recovery with vital nutrients such as lactoferrin, growth factors, and prolon-rich polypeptides. Colostrum is a natural milk-like fluid produced by mammals immediately following delivery of the newborn. And while colostrum is a dairy product, it does not contain milk or lactose. So most people with lactose intolerance usually find colostrum very easily digestible and beneficial to gut health. You can use one scoop a day. You can mix it in things like coffee or mix it in shakes or even yogurt, or even some of your baked food recipes. As I mentioned, has a lot of health benefits, including research demonstrating the improvement in a reduction in inflammation, promoting good gut flora, and supporting restoring leaky gut to normal permeability. And what I love best is that Equip Foods is very ethically focused. Their cows are humanely raised and ethically treated, and cows produce an excess of colostrum when nursing. So only after their babies get what they need are they able to source the excess colostrum for use in their products. There is 3 grams of colostrum in each scoop, and one serving in comparison to main competitors has just 1 gram. And research demonstrates that this dose, the 3 grams, actually promotes more benefits to gut health, immune function, recovery, and vitality. So if you'd love to take care of your health, you can go to www.equipfoods.com/Cynthia20 to get 20% off your first order. That's www.equipfoods.com/Cynthia20. You definitely want to check this out.
Oh, I love that. Now, you've mentioned, and you talk about it in the book as well, the role of faith and the role of your faith and how important that has been for you. How do you practice your faith now at this stage of your life? Do you formally go to church, or is it more of just a personal relationship with God or the universe?
It's always been a personal relationship for me, just because I got into it in such a, I mean, I don't want to say unique way. I feel like everybody has this. I mean, when a lot of people have these, because quote unquote, come to Jesus moment, no pun intended. But I hated religion growing up, because I thought that if God was good and that if he was real, like, why is my life in disarray? You know, why is all this horrible stuff happening to me? And then I just, you know, so I had this warped relationship with it. And then, like, once my life started to fall apart emotionally, like I talked about with my unhealthy relationship to exercise and external validation and stuff, I was ironically with Todd Durkin, and we were on a run. We were in San Diego, and he was like, man, you have everything. You've got, you're a good looking dude. You've got, like, your life figured out. You know, you have a good business. People really like you. You have a great story, like all these things, but you need some, like, faith. Like, I feel like there's something missing in your life. And so around that same time, one of my training clients was a pastor at this non-denominational church. And the last time I'd been to a non-denominational church, it was like a rock concert. And it was so weird to me. I was like, what is going on here? This is so strange. From where I grew up, like old school Greek Orthodox, where like none of that like existed. It was completely like the opposite. And this guy was like, hey man, like you should start coming to church with me. And I was like, nah, I'm not. He's like, well, go to Chipotle. And I'm like, nah, I'm not. I eat healthy. I'm not going to Chipotle. And he just kept nudging me and nudging me. And then finally, like after talking to Todd and just having like these situations, like where my life just wasn't working out in the way that it was. And, you know, I'd started to go into therapy and stuff. I called this guy and I just said, hey man, I think I'm ready to give this Jesus thing a try. And I think it felt like I just told him that he won like $100 million. I was like, why is this guy so happy? I couldn't figure it out. And then I went to his office and he like had me do this prayer. And then I just started crying. And I kind of tear up a little bit when I think about it, because I remember just walking out of the church, and it's right down the street from where I live, and just calling my mom, and like for the first time, like apologizing to her for like the way I behaved, and just saying I was like actually, like that I was actually sorry. And then I wasn't just saying sorry just to like get her to say she loved me or something. And then I started to realize that even though I wasn't proud of what I had done and proud of my life, the way I lived before, God was, because now he not only helped me transform my own pain, but I was helping others transform their pain as well. And I started to get really comfortable with my past, and I started to really identify with this whole like resurrection theme of like resurrection and becoming new. And that's how it's really shaped my relationship with faith up until this day. I mean, I used to go to church frequently, and then during the pandemic, things went online, so I didn't go as much. And now like it's, I'll do whatever I can to, I mean, I do what I can to stay connected. I'm obviously still have a relationship with God and a Christian, but it's definitely evolved where I also believe in like other forms of spirituality as well, whether it be meditation, being in nature, stuff like that. So to me, it's like, I look at it and like, all right, am I a good person? Do I treat other people in the way that Jesus would behave? Yes or no? And then can I look myself in the mirror and admit when I'm wrong? Like, do I have that kind of conviction? Because I do. I mean, there's times I still like am wrong. I mean, a lot, right? And maybe it's not as severe as when I was a kid, but there's stuff I'll say, or I'll get an email and I'll respond right away. You know, and I'll end up calling like one of my mentors and like, man, like I feel really bad. I just like, you know, responded very impulsively and I don't think I should have. And so I think that's a true tell sign that I still feel convicted in some way that I could be behaving differently in certain ways, because I'm not here to say that I'm this perfect human. I'm still very flawed. I think the difference is that I'm growing constantly. I own it. I'm not afraid to talk about it. And that I think that's just the ultimate gift of life, is being able to acknowledge when you're wrong, figuring out how you can grow from it, and not thinking that I know everything. Because I realized that, like, from my cellmate helping me, I mean, when I was in jail, I realized I didn't know everything. So it got me used to like seeking out mentorship from other people and learning from others and realizing that I wasn't the smartest person in the room and being able to get comfortable with that. Because there was times in my life where I thought I knew everything, and I thought that I was right, and that people, you know, hated me and the world was against me. And that, you know, almost led to my death, and almost, and it led to me going to jail. So I'm super thankful for my relationship with God, because I think faith is everything. I think without faith, like, you know, if you didn't have faith, I mean, it means that you wouldn't have taken a chance on yourself. And if you don't take a chance, it means that you never believed in yourself. If you didn't believe in yourself, it means that you didn't have any kind of hope in what you stand for. If you don't have any kind of hope in what you stand for, like, what does that say about your meaning and your purpose and what's in your heart? And I think it's so important, whether you're a believer in God or not, to have faith in that, believing that when you're in the thick of darkness, I know I'm going down a rabbit hole here, but like when you're in the thick of it, like faith is what keeps you going. Like that belief in the unseen, of knowing that, like, all right, like, I don't know how this is going to end up. I don't know when I'm going to get out of this thing, but I know that if I keep moving forward and I keep doing the right thing, eventually I will see light. And I think fear, which is in my mind the opposite of faith, keeps people kind of frozen in that place of darkness and even like turning around and going back to the same levels of comfort and same patterns because they're so scared to move forward and what that kind of change would look like.
Well, and it's interesting because one of the podcasts I listened to in prep for today was your conversation with Dr. Tara Swart. And at the very beginning of the conversation, she talks about an abundance mindset that's highly influenced by oxytocin, the hormone oxytocin, versus scarcity mindset, fear, or fear of lack really fuels cortisol. And that survival fear mechanism in our bodies can influence the way that we think and the choices that we make in terms of neuroplasticity and so many other things. And so a lot of what I'm hearing from you is faith. Your faith has allowed you to have a mindset of abundance, which has led you down a different path. And I'm so glad and so grateful that we connected. I've so enjoyed this conversation. I would love for you to share with listeners how to connect with you, how to connect to your amazing podcast, for which I will be a guest next month, how to purchase your books or check out your work online.
Well, thanks again for having me on. I mean, I really appreciate it, especially given that this is like newer territory for you. I really appreciate you giving me a shot and exposing my story to your audience. I'm really thankful for that. And again, I'm thankful that we connected and looking forward to having you on my show. The best place to find me is just through my website. It's dougbopst.com. I mean, there you can, if you want to buy the books, if you want to check out the podcast, it's there. If you want to learn more about me, it's there as well. Podcast is called The Adversity Advantage, and it's available wherever you get your podcast, whether that be Apple, Spotify, YouTube, etc. And then on social media, I'm most active, I would say, on Instagram, which I'm at Doug Bopst. So thanks again for having me on. Hope the audience gets a lot of value out of this.
Absolutely.
If you love this podcast episode, please leave a rating and review, subscribe, and tell a friend.